So we thought this was the theme, and this is all from Matthew 13, and it worked so well with Susan's sermon last night and all of these things. And we're missing quotation marks in the thing. I will open my mouth to tell stories is Jesus talking and us talking. So just so you know, next time around, we'll put the quotation marks back. Hi, everyone.
Hi.
I can't believe we're sitting. This is astonishing. There are more chairs over there.
There's
a couple back here. There's a couple up here. Are there people behind me?
Yes.
Hi, people behind me. I'm Diane Jacobson. I say this not for you because you now know this, but for the tape, for posterity. Hi, posterity. I have indeed been teaching at Luther Seminary for 28 years, where I am now retired and am not retired through being the director of the Book of Faith Initiative for the ELCA. And my other information for the day is I am a proud AIM.
Yes.
Thank you. Welcome back from two sessions yesterday into the mighty session today. You are a gadol group. Yes. You're big. You're gadol. You're large. Just before we move on in Jonah, we got all through all of chapter one. Are there remaining thoughts or things that you've been mulling over? Over for some of you, your very short night, and for other, you don't take my Hebrew. All right, here's from yesterday. Anybody need from yesterday? We'll get around to yesterday. I'll put them up here from yesterday. Things left over in your that you've been dreaming about? Thinking about?
I want to know how many class periods it takes you to teach Jonah.
How many class periods it takes me to teach Jonah? You know, I haven't taught Jonah for a long time. So I misjudged how long it was going to take me. I thought I was going to do it in two sessions. Clearly, that's not going to be true. So I'm thinking now 2.5.
How about 3? Doesn't it take 3 days?
3 days. Oh. All right. Does that mean we'll be coming back from hell when I finish? So I'll have a question for you. Think with me about the character of those pagan sailors. Think about the character of those pagan sailors. Anything about their character you want to raise up for the group? They were bright. Yeah, they thought kind of like the ship. Right? They could think. What are they characterized by? What do they do? They pray. You know, they pray a lot. These pagans pray. What were you going to say?
They ask questions.
These pagans ask questions. It's a wonderful characteristic of them. They are open to not knowing the truth.
They have faith.
I think they were also shrewd.
They were a little shrewd. Huh? We like this word, shrewd.
They acted in love.
They care about life. They were trying hard to preserve life.
They held everybody accountable for praying.
They held everyone accountable for praying. You know, someone yesterday said, do we know what faiths there were? And I said to somebody at lunchtime, I missed my opportunity to answer really quickly and say, they were Muslims. Now, what about the character of Jonah? What do we know about him as we come into chapter 2? Come on in. There is room for all. Let's see. There's some chairs back there. There's a few chairs. And there's a few chairs. There's one over here. There's floors. One here. There's two upstairs. You know, as the Book of Faith director of the LCA, I gotta tell you, my heart is going pitter patter. I mean, Bible study with no sitting room. Life is good. So Jonah, there's a seat in front. That's Elijah's chair. Elijah's chair, but somebody can use it. And there's one there. Oh, right in the center. Oh, like this. Oh, okay. Jonah, fearful. He's fearful. He's fearful. Yeah, he's stubborn. He is stubborn. Last night we talked to someone, said, you know, when he goes down and lies down in the hull of this, he's like Jesus sleeping through the storm, which I had never thought of because I'm not a Jonah fan. I am kind of a Jesus fan, but I'm not a Jonah fan, so I hadn't sort of thought of them. But then said, oh no, that's actually one of the things that a lot of people talk about, and people talk about in their small groups. So is the sleeping, the capacity to sleep, a good thing or a bad thing? Is he an anti-Jesus? Or, yeah.
Well, as a sailor, when you are in a storm or you're on a ship, everyone has a job. Everyone has something to do. So it's not like I don't think he's at all Christ-like by finding a place to go to sleep.
Right.
He's completely avoidant.
Yes.
And any other person who would have gone and done such a thing probably would have been whipped and keel-hauled and thrown over the side.
He's disengaged. He would have been punished under normal circumstances. He's not helping. He is not part of this community.
Exactly.
Right? He is an anti-pagan community. Right? You with me?
Yep.
But the other thing we saw about Jonah is that he's a darn good theologian, theoretically. But it doesn't happen to touch his life.
He
says the right things. I worship God, maker, the Lord. The Lord, by the way, is the name of God, right? So there are actually two characters in this that have a name, Jonah and God. The Lord, maker of the sea and the dry land. Good theology. Doesn't happen to touch anything, given what we're doing this week, about theology. If it's good theology, has to be practiced. So who in this group is practicing good theology, and who is speaking good theology?
Well, the sailors are practicing.
The sailors are, and then they come to speak. Isn't it interesting that their practice leads them to good understanding? Jonah's good understanding doesn't do much for his practice.
No.
All right, moving right along. Today,
the sailors are very self-serving as well, because they say they kind of instantly convert. And you have to, it's like they cry out to the Lord.
And that's self-serving.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah, interesting. You bring, you know, meaning in text, and this is, excuse me, those of you in this room who are not Lutheran, I'm going to talk Lutheran, and I do not mean when I say this that other people don't have these same insights, you know. If I did that, I'd be right in Jonah's chair. And I don't mean that, but I also know that most of us here are thinking about how do we talk about Lutheran theology, so I am going to do some of that. So just those of you, bear with me. we know that meaning is made not just inside a text, but in the interaction between us and the text. That there isn't a single meaning that sits in the text, and then our job as good Bible study people is to discover the true meaning. In fact, meaning happens, this is one of the ways we talk about proclamation. Meaning is always new, it's always an event. It's always both a hearing and a telling, a hearing and a speaking. And so what I might hear about what the sailors are and what you might hear, they're both true. I mean, there are limits. There are sometimes I can say, you know, the text just doesn't even allow you to think that. There are parameters to this. But on the other hand, one of the reasons we do this in community, what Jonah didn't understand, is that you don't really ever get meaning without others. Without others helping you get meaning. Yes.
Chair. I'll tell her there's a chair.
Oh, chair. I'm sorry. Like, why are you pointing? There's a chair there, too. Oh.
Diane?
Like, am I saying something
Diane?
Wrong? Yeah.
Jonah is a weak character in that he's running from God. And on the other side, he must be a strong character. If I was running from God, who wanted me to do something, I could not go to sleep.
He sleeps. He seems to know who he is. You know, this is very modern. We're at peace when we really know who we are. What if what we know about who we are happens to be dead wrong?
Yeah.
All right, moving right along, she says. Today we're gonna also continue with literary thinking, but instead of thinking about narrative, we're gonna think a bit about poetry. Because we're about to get to a psalm in the middle of the story, which is really not at all unusual for biblical narratives. You know about songs in the middle of stories. For example, Miriam sings a song in the middle of Exodus. Deborah sings a song in the middle of Judges. It's a J word. Hannah sings a song at the beginning of Samuel. It's all over Luke, right? So to sing a song in the middle of a narrative, it is often really, really important. And we are apt to skip over this part of Jonah. First of all, because the Hebrew is so hard that if you're studying it in Hebrew, you don't want to read it. But secondly, we're not as good. You know, poetry, it's not part of our story. So I want to spend a little time thinking about how you read a psalm in Hebrew, right? Or how you read it in English and how you can help. So here we go. I won't spend tons of time on this, but I hope you have your outline from yesterday.
Yep.
I still have a few outlines from yesterday. Could somebody hand these out? Here, thanks. So here's the deal. Hebrew poetry is all about a parallel line. Just raise your hand if you need one, and my Vanna here will help. Over there. Just chapter 2. Share. It's nice. Okay. All right, settle down, folks. This is a big room. When I first learned Hebrew poetry is about two things. It's about imagery, and it's about the parallel line. It's all about the parallel line. Now, back in the ancient days when I was at seminary, at Union Seminary in New York, when I learned about parallelism from Bishop Lowe of Holy Memory, he taught us that, I didn't learn from him, that was the guy who invented this, that there are three kinds of parallelism. Synonymous parallelism, when the first line is the same as the second. Antithetical parallelism, where the first line is the opposite of the other. And synthetic parallelism, when it doesn't work that way. This is singularly unhelpful. For one thing, I flunked this test because I could never tell whether they were actually synonymous or antithetical, because the words seemed the opposite, but the meaning seemed the same, so it just didn't make any sense. Well, thanks be to God, there are some very, very interesting people working on Hebrew poetry these days. Well, actually, for the last 30 years, but two of whom are named Kugel and Alter. And what they say, this is what Hebrew parallelism is. You ready?
Yeah.
A and what's more B. Isn't that brilliant? A and what's more B. And your job, if you take this on to read Hebrew poetry, is to figure out the relationship between A and B. That's it. Does it repeat it? Does it complete it? Does it amplify it? Does it multiply it? Can you not figure out, does it narrate a story? And the more, if you try to figure that out, it's very helpful. So I like that. How are they related? Now, a slightly more complex, and those people who hate complexity, just whistle or something. No, whistle silently to yourself and don't pay any attention. But I think this is totally cool, and I think everybody can get it if you bear with me, all right? Even though it looks like gobbledygook. I put this chart on your handouts from Adele Berlin, one of my favorite Bible scholars. And what Adele Berlin says about Hebrew poetry is this. It works on two levels and three different aspects. It works on a word level. So there's a word in A, there are words in A that relate to words in B. And a line level. There are lines. The whole line A relates to the whole line B. Okay? You with me? So then there's a lexical, semantical level. That means meaning. And then there's a phonological. That means sound. All right? So we're going to briefly think about these three different things. So let me find where I am. Okay, the grammatical level. Okay, sometimes A relates to B. Like, there's a word in A that's in singular, and then when you see it repeated, it turns to plural. Or it's positive in one line and negative in the other. Or a pronoun in one line and a noun in the other. And that's what creates the interest. If it's just repeated words, it's the same. And a line could say, noun, verb, direct object, or subject, verb, direct object, verb, subject. And that's what makes it kind of interesting, this kind of flip. The thing is, you don't always get the same thing in English that you do in Hebrew, so that's why you have people like me who play with languages. So it's very cool to sort of figure that out. Now, look at one. Oh, I'm not going to look at one line. We'll get to that. Okay. Phonological, how it sounds. Now, here's the trouble. As soon as you translate a poem from one language to the other, you lose the sound.
Yep.
So she sells seashells by the seashore. You can hear that in English and know why that's an interesting line. But if I translate it to any other language where the S's aren't there, or the SH's aren't there, you think, why is that an interesting line? Now, often in English, what makes something a poem is that it rhymes. When I first studied Hebrew in Edinburgh, there was a guy, we were studying some Hebrew poetry, and he says, when is there going to be real Hebrew poetry that rhymes? But what makes a poet, how do we know when we looked at, when Susan was doing her wonderful poem yesterday, that it was poetry? It's the sound of the words, quickening yeast, blue plumes, body clothes, you know? It's not necessarily rhyme, it's rhythm. Well, there's all kinds of cool things in Hebrew poetry that help you. So I'm going to try this and read you one verse, the opening verse of Jonah's song, which says, Karathi Matsarali El Adonoi Wayaanani Mebetan Sha'ol Shiba'athi Shamarta Holi. Now, you don't know any Hebrew. Well, some of you do. But did you hear a repeated thing? E. Now, if you were listening and you knew any Hebrew, you would hear, anybody want to tell me? Me. Actually, you'd think you were in the middle of, you know, that Disney film with the little birds. You'd know that whoever is doing this is preoccupied with the meanness of his life. So that line is very cool on a number of different levels, but we'll talk about it in a second. All right, one more thing. And this the third way is about meaning. Now, bear with me here. Sometimes you hear a line, and the next line pretty much totally repeats the notion of the first line. So the opening of this psalm that we have here, I called to the Lord out of my distress, and I called out of my distress to the Lord, and he answered me. Out of the belly of Sheol I cried, and you heard my voice. And those are pretty square lines. You could do the little, it changes the noun here, and it changes the verb here, but beginnings and ends of psalms tend to be pretty square like that, right? The first line, which is, I think, why modern... All right, I'm going to make a knock against modern music. If you don't like that, just... Not modern music. What am I thinking? Praise music. Praise music loves the beginnings and ends of psalms because it's real straightforward. And it's all just like, that's one way a line works. It could be exactly the same or the exactly opposite, but it would still be square. So synonymous and antithetical parallelism are the same in this. Are you with me? Is that too complicated? All right. It's probably too complicated and you're still with me. Good. You're so good. Now, sometimes a line, instead of going that way, finishes the thought or changes the thought, right? This psalm in front of us is a little hard to do that with. Some psalms I could find a lot of them, but the best one I could find is verse 9, which says, but I, with the voice of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you what I have vowed I will pay. Deliverance belongs to the Lord. So how does that second line relate to the first line? Is it totally unrelated? Your job, if you're going to do A and B, is to figure out how B is related to A. And in some way, what is the voice I am going to voice? The words I am going to sing? Deliverance belongs to the Lord. So it continues the first line. You with me? So what Adele Berlin does, says the first one's paradigmatic, that's a fancy word, and the second one's syntagmatic. And the way you read Hebrew poetry is, the art of reading it is to get caught between the paradigmatic and the syntagmatic. That lots of lines kind of do both. They go into parallel and they move you. So is that way more than you ever know about Hebrew poetry? The other thing we have to do is just hear the psalm and hear how the movement. Sometimes psalms are as much narratives as they are songs. So I'm going to read chapter 2, and I want you to listen. And we're not going to break into small groups yet. We're going to save that for chapter 3. But we are going to ask our devotional question, What word or phrase strikes you? What word or phrase strikes you, and maybe why? And you ready? You don't have to look at it. You can, if you really can't stand it, you can just look at it, read with me, or you can just listen. Then Jonah prayed to the Lord his God from the belly of the fish, saying, I called to the Lord out of my distress, and he answered me. Out of the belly of Sheol I cried, and you heard my voice. You cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas, and the floods surrounded me. All your waves and your billows passed over me. Then I said, I am driven away from your sight. How shall I look again upon your holy temple? The waters closed in over me. The deep surrounded me. Weeds were wrapped around my head. At the roots of the mountain, I went down to the land whose bars closed upon me forever. Yet you brought up my life from the pit, O Lord my God. As my life was ebbing away, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer came to you into your holy temple. Those who worship vain idols forsake their true loyalty. But I, with a voice of thanksgiving, will sacrifice to you what I have vowed. I will pay. Deliverance belongs to the Lord. Then the Lord spoke to the fish, and it spewed Jonah out onto the dry land. Actually, upchucked. Hurled. It's actually not the same Hebrew word. It should have been the same. It's the only correction I want to make. So a word or phrase that struck you, just you can only tweet me an answer. You have 100 or 65 characters left? 140 characters left.
The fact that he talks about others praying to vain idols.
The fact that he talks about.
Yeah. He announces that God hears him before, he like tells God what God's going to do.
He tells God, God heard me. You're going to hear me, God.
Ross, up my life from the pit.
Up the life from the pit. That's right.
The whole
place
of temple.
That it weaved around your head. Yeah.
The whole place of temple. How keeps going back to temple?
What's that? Yeah. So the mention of the temple.
He said he was driven away when in fact he fled.
He speaks to the Lord in past tense.
Huh.
Then I said.
Right, it's a past tense. I am driven away.
I did this, I did that.
Yeah. Lots of eyes.
And
those of you back there, you are part of this class. Shout it out. Shout it out.
Images of the belly and the deeps.
And
belly and the deeps.
And shell at the same time. The chaos.
The chaos. You're such good hearers.
Weaves were wrapped around my head. I thought he was inside the fish. What happened? How did he get weaves?
Yeah. How does he have weeds wrapped around his head when he's really inside this?
Seaweed.
I need to correct, by the way, from yesterday. Somebody did ask me whether he was actually swallowed by a dog. Let me explain. Dog is the word for fish in Hebrew. He was swallowed by a fish in Hebrew. That's a dog, which is God backwards, right? All right. Never mind. Okay, let's read it together. I mean, these were wonderful things you were listening, you were hearing. Okay, so, starting in verse 2, we've already said that all these eyes, I called to the Lord out of my distress, and he answered me out of the belly of Sheol. And you notice how it moves, you know, that interesting word movement, it moves from he to you, from third person address to direct address. That happens all the times in Psalms. And a lot of our translations, especially for worship, and I know this because I'm one of the ones who helped translate the Psalms in the ELW, is that in order to be non-sexist, a really great value. We changed a lot of things to you, so it could be direct address, really great value for worship, but we miss that that movement in the psalm that goes from the third person to the second person. You're always making choices. You know, you're always making choices. Okay, so it moves to you. Great move. You listened. But this notion of pronouncement, it isn't a question, of course. Jonah is not fond of actually himself asking questions. The other people ask questions. Where do questions work in faith? Okay. In my distress, I called. Verse 2. You cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas, and the floods surrounded me. Actually, the word for flood here isn't the usual word for flood. It's the word river, nahar. And it's that notion of those rivers of the deep that are down there in the underworld. All your waves and your billows passed over me. This question of, wait a minute, why is that happening when in fact, is he describing what happened to him? Is this a historical description? Or is this the way all psalms, one of the principal images of chaos in people's lives, is about drowning? I mean, look at the laments. All three. It's one of the things about how water functions in our scriptures. Water always means one of two things, or else both. It's either life-giving or it's death-dealing. And so, I mean, you get it from Genesis 1, right? And Genesis 2 together. The rivers are life-giving, the floods are death-dealing. And right into our baptism. Mm-hmm. So that a lament song, or a praise song that begins with a lament, is talking about drowning. It isn't just about Jonah being historical here, mm-hmm. although it certainly is that. It is also gathering up the tradition. This is how the Hebrew people sing to God in times of trouble. It couldn't be a better lament praise song. You use water imagery. That's the way you talk it. And let's see, I haven't gotten to that verse yet. I'll get there.
Diane, it also mirrors that going down.
It also mirrors, thank you.
Went down to Joppa, went down into the boat, went down, and so now here
now
is,
he's really going down.
Yeah.
On his 3-day journey.
Until you get to, you brought me up. And
right.
So.
Lovely. Lovely. I'm missing something and I can't remember.
It reminds us of hell. Going down to hell. He's going to his own hell.
Yeah, he's going to real literal hell and to his own hell. There's no question. Have we talked about, I think I skipped a word, but I can't find it, so we'll just skip it. And I said, actually, in Hebrew, it's eyes are part of the verb. If you say, I said, he said, she said, they said, it's always part of the verb, but every once in a while, you stick in an extra pronoun. Ani, I said, and so you know that the guy's really stuck on himself. I said, I'm driven away from before your eyes. Remember? That's a lovely comment. I love that comment. Excuse me? You were not driven away. You fled. And then what does he say? Where would God's sight have been? In the temple. What is his theology? Where does God...
God's in a building.
God's in a building. Where does God live? God lives in the temple. Where's the temple?
In Jerusalem.
You know? Whose God is he? Ours. What is sacred space? The temple. Who cares that God...
God created the heavens, or the earth and the dry land, or the sea and the dry land. Because God lives there. So I'm driven away from your sight. Okay. No, I fled. But on the way, he is saying, if you read this narratively, right? When you gave me the commission to go to Nineveh, you, O Lord, were driving me away from your sight. Because you live in the temple. You with me? Okay.
But what about the first thing I did was flee, and then after that it was sort of like the consequence he was driven away.
Yeah.
Because he was swallowed.
Right. So it's all these multiple layers, these wonderful multiple layers that are here. But so far we are in the midst of classic psalm. Mm-hmm. It's still classic. I mean, this could be in the Psalter, and we'd rejoice and be glad. And then it says, the waters closed in, what it says in the NRSV is, the waters closed in over me. What you miss is the waters closed over my nephesh, which is a word we usually translate as soul or self, but you know, all body parts are metaphors. And it's really hard because different languages have different metaphors. Yesterday we were talking about heart and heart and mind. And in English, heart and mind means intellect, and heart means emotion. Well, in Hebrew, that's just not true. Mind means will, commitment. So does heart. I mean, you do, the body parts lead someplace. Emotion is the belly in Hebrew. Heart is sometimes the intention. Or, yeah.
I had a note in my Bible that says the waters were at my throat.
Exactly. That's the body part. Right? The body part, nephesh, that we translate soul or self, is the throat. So, the weeds are at my throat, my life. It's about breath. Children, are you married? You know, it's about breath. That's when your life is choked out of you. So the waters closed in over me, the deep surrounded me, weeds were around my head. At the roots of the mountain, I went down to the land, and now the land is Sheol. Huh? The land whose bars closed over me forever, yet you brought my nephesh, it's my hayah, my life, my being up from the pit, O Lord, my God. Yeah. As my life was ebbing away, as my nephesh was my throat, as I was losing my life, my breath, my nephesh, as it was ebbing away, I remembered the Lord. Okay. And my prayer came up to you where?
In
the holy temple, your sacred space. And then we get the line that makes this psalm hysterical. And you all of a sudden know this is a parody of a psalm. It's a real psalm, and it's all right in the middle. No logic, no connection, no nothing. You get those who observe, actually keep. And, oh, how do you do this? You have to think of the Ten Commandments. You have to think of lies and idols. And they're the two words for the Ten Commandments here. The hobble, the nothingness, the vanity. The vain nothingness. That's what it says. Those who keep vain nothingness, those who worship idols. I mean, it's a great translation, but it's got deep roots. Their chesed, their loving kindness, their devotion to each other and to God, their following Jesus's two great commandments, theirs, they have abandoned. All right, so let me say this in plain English. Ha! Those who worship, serve, it's those who serve vain idols, idols of vanity, they have abandoned their love of God and me, their chesed. Oh? What? Why is this in this song? You tell me. Why is it here? Why is Jonah saying? Yeah, yeah.
But that's so that you can set up the contrast with the next line.
Yes. Go ahead.
And say, I mean, a lot of songs do this, making some comment about those who worship idols. But I render thanksgiving to Yahweh, who saves me or whatever else. I mean, this is making a distinction.
Right. Those poor, sad, yucky people who have abandoned their commitment to the life of others and their love of God. But I vows, and I give voice of thanks. And think back to chapter 1. And what did those sailors do?
They had their altar call.
They had their altar call. And what's the last line of what they do?
They sacrifice.
They vow vows, and they do one more thing. They fear a great fear. Somehow Jonah forgot that one. You know, he leaves out the fear, the great fear, because he's got it down. And he knows who's bad and good, so that who Santa Claus is going to visit. I know who's going to, and it ain't them. They worship vain idols. They're bad. They've abandoned all the things that are good. But deliverance belongs to the Lord, who is mine, and who resides in his holy temple. And isn't that?
One thing that struck me in your first reading was I said, or something came into my head, like we're thrown back on our dependence on God. And then as you're talking, I think about all these things in terms of like addiction and the 12 steps and stuff, where people come and they say, "Well, I was really in the belly, and then you delivered me." And in a way, then that sentence to me sort of is a reflection maybe of himself, where he says,
I wish it had been about himself.
Yeah.
But it's, what's so striking in the Hebrew is that it's so third person.
Okay.
You know, those who, ones who do that, but I, you know, in contrast. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I too was thinking that even though he moves to third person, that he does this self-reflection and becomes aware, sort of reawakens to who he is. So his self-view affects his worldview, and it's kind of making that transition from self to world.
So you all are, you're liking Jonah a whole lot better than I am.
He's in a shield, he hasn't even learned his lesson.
Yeah, he's, you know, It's those vain, those who worship vain idols. Remember yesterday, I asked the question, what do you think of these pagan sailors when they are worshiping their own god? And we, being the liberal cold knights that we are, have a hard time judging people for worshiping other gods. But Jonah had no such difficulties. He knew they were worshiping idols.
Is he saying, kind of, you owe me, because I'm not...
Oh, that's a really interesting question. What a lovely question. Is he kind of saying to God, you owe me, I'm not one of them. I know where you live. I got your address.
Made their vows and made their sacrifice. So he was under the water and being swallowed by a fish.
Yeah.
I think.
But true, narratively. But we know. I mean, there's a, I get your point. Yeah.
Isn't this a kind of religious arrogance that we see?
Isn't this a kind of religious arrogance that we see? Bingo, give this woman a gold star.
And he's asking for a second chance. And how often, when we're asking for forgiveness of our sins, I'm saying my, I'm making personal. You ask for forgiveness of the same thing that you asked for yesterday, and you say, give me another chance, I will do better. And that's what he's doing.
You think he's asking for a second chance? Do you think he thinks he's done anything terribly wrong? Is there one word in here about his sin? Is there one moment when he says, oh dear God, I tried to flee from you, and you are trying to teach me a lesson, and now that I have been into the depths of hell, I have heard your lesson well, and I will return knowing better this time. Who you are, and to who I am, I am a sinner.
But if the narration ended right there and didn't go on to the next chapter, one might think that the Lord says, okay, you learned your lesson.
Yes, we are wondering why the Lord could possibly even save an unrepentant sinner like Jonah. We are, although with humor. Because I think when he commands the fish to vomit Jonah onto the dry land, he's like, get rid of this guy. My precious fish cannot sustain this garbage for one more moment. All right, I realize it's a little, you know, did I say I was going to get through?
If this is a story of the superiority of the God of the Hebrew people, then this is a story, and we have to keep in mind the focus, the point. And so this superior God is getting this guy over there, and he'll eventually get there, and the people will repent.
Yeah. I'm going to pick up our little hymn. All Jesus did was tell stories. All Jesus did was tell stories. How else do you do good theology? I mean, there are other ways, I grant you, but none of them is good. So one of the things a story can do that you can't do in most systematic theology, although there are a few good systematicians out there, is that you can, that a story doesn't have one point. A story doesn't have just one thing it's saying. A story can say lots of things, even a little short thing like a woman takes yeast, you know? It's got, what story can do for us is expand our world and our imaginations and bring us in. So I'm always just slightly resistant, actually more than slightly resistant to saying it means this.
Yes.
Right? Because what it does is constantly bring us in and say, oh, look, it means this, and it means this, and it means this. It certainly also means this, right? That it is about God's, about who the right God is. Mm-hmm. But it's about lots more than that. And so when one of the reasons to do a Bible study in all this outrageously disgusting detail, glorious detail, is that it's only when you pause and give yourself space to look at the details that those 12 different layers and these multiple conversations come in. If we tell the story so that we get to the point, it's so American and modern of us to get to the point. Could you just get to the point? There's a way in which we kill scripture when we do that. When we just get to the point.
But the other side is to get lost in front of the tree.
Well, this is true. You do get lost in all of this glorious detail and never get to any point, which is equally problematic. It is true. It
this is
true.
A good example of the Lord is slow to anger and abides in steadfast love.
Yes, well, we'll get to that. And exactly what Jonah thinks of that. All right. We clearly will not get to it today. All right, I'm going to move on because I can. Because I want to make sure I do this. There are historical questions you can ask texts. We can go to our historical questions. This set of questions, when you bring historical questions to a text, comes with an understanding that the scripture, among many other things, it's a book, it's a devotional guide, it is also ancient literature. It was written by a people of different at a different time in a different place. And you learn things if you pay attention to other times and other places. In fact, it's really hard to read with sometimes without knowing those. What are the sensibilities and experiences different? The problem is, and when you say historical questions to a Bible text, people ask this question of Jonah. So, was Jonah really swallowed by a whale?
No.
Right? A historical question in most people's imaginations becomes, what really happened? Tell me what really happened. That's history. And it's highly problematic. And then someone yesterday told me she was kicked out of a Bible study on Jonah because she asked that question. Because it questioned people's faith. People's faith becomes centered on what really happened. Instead of saying, what is true about this book is it's mirroring the truth about us. And we'll get to that. But we're not going to get to it right now because we're going to think about history. The best, most central historical question to me is this, and it's the first one on your handout yesterday's. What insights from history would be helpful to know in order to hear, study, read, understand the plain meaning of this text better? Are there insights from history that could help me read this better? Those are great historical questions. Now, there are a couple of problems. One, there are a lot of historical questions we can't answer. Mm-hmm. Only we're scholars, some of us, and we make things up. So then, you know, and then we're really sure we're right. Actually, occasionally we are. But that's one problem. The other problem with history, if you think that history is the only important thing, you need an expert in it, right? You need experts, and the text can get stolen from you because you have to know the right answers, and you can't read this text if you don't know the right answers to these history questions. So it's a kind of catch-22. Some history is really, really important. And to get to the way history works best, you do this. You have to decide, in some ways, when a text was written and what kind of person wrote it and to what kind of audience. Sometimes speculation, sometimes not, sometimes good speculation. And then you work by analogy. You say, as those post-exilic people were in their day, so we who are living in the United States of America today are like them in this way. So as Jonah spoke to them, so Jonah speaks to us in the ways we are like him. So in this case, if you think this text was written really late, which I would claim is true, because the Hebrew is late Hebrew, so that's how I would date it. So if I claim that, then I would say, what were people living in post-exilic Jerusalem, Israel, really thinking about? Well, one of the things we know they were really thinking about is how horrible it is for to get mixed up with people of other cultures. And how you have to kind of stick it out on your own in order to be faithful to God. So then you say, are we like that? And then you say, can Jonah speak to us as Jonah spoke to people at that time? So that's kind of the way history. Now, how do I get folks involved in history? My favorite historical exercise of all time comes from my colleague, Rolf Jacobson, who stole it from his colleague. He teaches at Augsburg College, whose name is now floating, and that's what happens when you steal things. So this is the exercise. You say, if you were writing a study Bible on the first two chapters of Jonah, where would you want a little asterisk, a little star, that gave you little historical information down at the bottom of the page? You don't have to know what it is. You just have to tell me what you want to know. Now, I'm not going to... because, you know, we're not going to do what I thought we were going to do. But, you know, we did what I didn't think we were going to do. Where would you put a star? Go ahead. Shout it out.
Nineveh.
You'd like to know where Nineveh is. And you'd like to know something about Nineveh.
And Joppa.
You'd like to know... And it's like Joppa, this is like reading the names out.
Tarshish. Meaning of Jonah's name.
Casting lots. The meaning of Jonah's name.
Your handy chart of body part equals X.
Body part equals X. You know, when you have a nephesh, does it mean throat and that kind of stuff. Cool. Now, not wanting to do PowerPoint today, I did a freehand map.
Oh, very nice.
Thank you. I knew I had to get to it today because I worked so hard on it. I'm sorry to people who are standing back there. You can come down. It's such fine artwork that you can All right, this is Israel. By the way, Israel is about the size of, it's smaller than New Jersey.
Yeah.
You know, now if you lived in New York, you'd laugh. All right. So Jerusalem is here. I forgot to put Jerusalem on the back. Map, that's the Sea of Galilee, that's the Dead Sea. It's a little tiny thing, all right? Over here is giant Nineveh, capital of Assyria. Back in the time of Tiglath-Pileser III, or the second, I can never remember which Roman numeral, that was a mighty kingdom, and Nineveh was the capital of this mighty kingdom, and they were known to be really bad. They were really bad to foreigners. They were really very oppressive people, right? At least from the history point of view. Actually, Babylon, which ends up defeating Assyria 200 years later, was much nicer. Assyria, Nineveh, that was the really wicked. They took over the north of Israel.
Right.
Right? So the first exile, when the north disappears, that's Assyria, and Nineveh with its capital. So what do people who live in Israel and who have a memory, because that's part of what makes them religious people, know about Nineveh?
Bad.
Villain bad. Okay. That's where he was told to go, right? Here's Joppa. It's on the sea. That, by the way, is the Mediterranean. I'm just, oh, I forgot Italy. Step back, die, you
And down here is Egypt, and that's Sinai, by the way. This is Africa. And he goes to Joppa to the coast, and there's Tarshish, off on the coast of Spain. You know, I mean, this is far away. As far, it's the end of the world. It is the end of the world. Or you can see it. So that's, oh, I know, I'm done. So that's, I'm gonna answer a few historical questions that you asked, and then we're gonna be done for the day, and we'll actually finish Jonah tomorrow, we think. Okay. Jonah, what does Jonah mean? Anybody know what Jonah means?
Dumb.
It means dove. Dove, D-O-V-E. Unless you think a dove is a nice, sweet thing to call him. Here's a quote from Hosea 7, verse 11. Ephraim has become like a dove, silly without and without sense. They call upon Egypt, they go to Assyria.
Were doves sacrificed in the temple?
Doves were sacrificed in the temple. Dove, though, in this case, is a metaphor for Israel itself. Yeah. I mean, in that. And silly and flippant and not very faithful. So, son of Amittai, which is, there is a historical thing. You can look in 2 Kings 14, and it talks about the Lord God's having a servant, Jonah, son of Amittai, the prophet. I mean, there was a historical prophet mentioned in 2 Kings, and the word Amittai is from truthfulness, ironically. We just talked about Nineveh. Yesterday we talked about casting lots, but let me just say a word about casting lots, and I will cast you out into coffee. Casting lots was a way of saying we will not let our own opinions influence this. We want a direct word from God. So if we cast lots, it's out of our hands into God's hands. So it was, in fact, in that logic, a very faithful thing to do, to cast lots. It wasn't a random thing. It was, let's get out of the way of the word from the divine.
Mm-hmm. So sort of an eeny, meeny, miny, moe.
Yeah, but God's in charge of moe. You know, God's in charge of who gets chosen. Which is why some churches still will choose their bishop in some ways by lot. Because it's in God's hands, and it's not just an election.
So it is God that prizes us away from the faithful.
It is God. Yeah. So go in peace, read Jonah. We will come back tomorrow.
A reminder about you.